Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast in association with Charles Tirrett, who will be featuring on the show over the course of the Pakistan-England series. They've got some exciting news to share, arguably as exciting as that of Rehan Ahmed being added to the England squad. It's about their new partner. First, they partnered up with Josh Butler, and now they've got none other than the number one ranked test batter in the world, Joe Root. I'm sure Joe will look just as slick as Joss in the Charles Tirrett Winter Collection. Speaking of looking slick, as those watching on YouTube will see, Phil and I are wearing Charles Tirrett today, with me in particular looking quite a bit smarter than I normally do.
Ben's in one.
And Ben's in one as well.
Ben's got so the garms.
If you're listening to the audio-only version, you'll just have to take our word for it. Charles Tirrett, the menswear retailer, are offering Wisden listeners a special 20% off using the promo code WISDEN22. That's Wisden followed by the number 22, from shirts, polos, chinos to knitwear. It's a one-stop shop to refresh your whole wardrobe. We are a couple of days away from the start of England's first test in Pakistan since 2005. England went full Bazball in their warm-up game, scoring more than 500 runs in a day, as well as sensationally adding 18-year-old leg-spinning all-rounder Rehan Ahmed to the squad. We'll be previewing the Pakistan series. We'll talk about the prospect of private money in the 100, Australia West Indies, some 2023 World Cup news, a new England squad, more list day records broken in India, and more. I'm Yaz Rana, and to get through all of that with me today is Mark Butcher, Phil Walker and Ben Gardner. Let's start with Rehan Ahmed. If he plays in Pakistan, he will become the youngest ever England's men's test cricketer. He only turned 18 in August. He's only played three first-class games. Butch, why do you think he's been picked?
I would imagine it's fairly self-evident why he's been picked. He's a real talent. He's come through. He's been on the radar for a while, I suppose, as an England under 19. And England are trying their very best, not necessarily to bypass county cricket. That's not quite what it means, but to try and identify the type of player that they need for whatever conditions they might be encountering, particularly on the road, and trying to fast-track those players that fit that sort of bill into being around the environment with the main squad, with the main aim of the more they are around the very best players that there are, the faster they learn, the quicker they assimilate, and the more chance you have of throwing them into the fray without them having to go through the sort of like the same apprenticeship, I suppose, as was deemed necessary for county players in the past. So, you know, he's a talented boy, that is for sure. And one thing that England are not afraid of is taking a big punt on talent.
I guess that's something that England have been doing since before Ben Stokes and Brendan McCullum came in. In the last 7 years, England have basically been picking someone who's 22 or younger every year, and it's sometimes worked and sometimes it's not. So that list of players is Sam Curran, Ollie Pope, Crawley, Hamid, Don Best, Ben Duckett, Tom Curran, Mason Crane have all played test cricket age 22 or under in the last 6 or 7 years. That's you know, in some cases that has worked, some cases it hasn't. I remember when there was an Arsenal player who played this season who was only 15, and there's a big discussion about, was it responsible to put him in that situation? You don't know how he's going to take the extra scrutiny, etc. Obviously, Rahon's 3 years older than that, but he's played so little professional cricket. Phil, do you reckon there's a possibility that a call up that early is actively detrimental?
No, I wouldn't see it like that. I think it's a slightly symbolic move, I think, at the moment. I can't imagine that he's going to play that first test match. I'd be surprised if he plays any of the three. But it's another sign, isn't it, from Stokes and McCullum that if you have something to offer them that is slightly outside the norm, then there are no barriers to you being brought into the fold. He's obviously, as Mark says, an interesting cricketer, almost unique, really, in that he bats. I mean, I think he smashed 28 in about 10 balls, right, in that game that you just mentioned. And is considered to be just as much of a batter as he is a really immensely talented young leggy who approaches the crease hard. There's a Yasir Shah element to the way he goes about his work. He's not quite as kind of considered, if you like, as, say, a Parkinson, you know, who has had a degree of criticism because of the pace that he bowls. He's a bit quicker through the air, and he's got maybe a bit more energy in his action than other leggies. But he's still trying to do the most impossible, near impossible job out there to become a red ball leg spinner. And he's a kid. So it's my eyebrows were raised just like everyone else's was, but I don't know. I don't think it really amounts to anything of any great significance just yet. The one caveat I would say is that all the norms, all the customs, all the accepted wisdom that we've been building up over the many years has been sort of routinely chucked out the window by the two bosses of English Test cricket. So you never know. You do never know. And if you've piled your squad with part-time spinners, all-rounders, basically, then perhaps he does get a gig in the third test match alongside Leach, in the slipstream of Leach. We'll probably come to what kind of conditions you're going to expect Pakistan in a minute, but I think it's stirring from a symbolic perspective, but I'd be very surprised if he gets a cap this winter.
I think for me, there's a lot to unpick from it. I think the first thing, as Phil says, that the pace at which he bowls would have been quite attractive to England. He's almost the first English sort of modern leg spinner that you see in quite a lot of white ball cricket around the world who bowls faster and is trying to outfox batters that way rather than with putting absolutely loads of, I mean, not to say he doesn't put revs on it, but to, you know, throw it up there to get it sort of drifting and turning. That's not the modern way, especially in white ball cricket. And that's Rian Ahmed is of that more almost Rashid Khan type. Not if he's quite as quick as him, but that's his mould rather than the classical leg spinner's way. I think there is, the age thing is interesting because, I mean, Rob Key was saying when he was called up, he said it was quite an interesting and revealing thing, things he was saying. First, he said that this was always the plan, and this was done to avoid scrutiny on Rian Ahmed, which I don't think it has done. I think if he was in that squad originally, he is one of a number of interesting people in there, and you'd end up probably actually focusing more on, say, Liam Livingstone's in there. He probably focus more on Will Jacks because he seems more likely to play. I mean, Ahmed might slip in there. Now he is this week's story. I mean, that
top of the show. Top of the show,
yeah, exactly.
Story.
That might be fine. That might not be. The other thing is that Rob Key says that, you know, he's not going to be the finished article for 4 or 5 years. I mean, he's a leg spinner and he's 18. He could easily not be the finished article for 10 years. And I think that'll be the important thing when looking at how he does develop from here on out. One of the things that Alistair Cook has said before is that, you know, before you get picked for England, you appear on that BBC sort of like ticker sidebar thing when you make a score. After you get picked for England, you appear there when you make a duck. And that is now where, that's what Rian Ahmed is in. When he plays that first, even if he doesn't play in Pakistan, when he plays that first county championship game next season, if he has a bad start, he throws a few half trackers down and he's, you know, 0 for 70 or 13 overs in that first game, that will be focused on more than it would have been if he wasn't in that squad. Now, they will know him better than any of us do. And whether he can cope with that and that sort of thing. But that is the scrutiny that is now being invited upon him by the choice they've made. The other thing, though, is that I do think that there is a route to him playing because there is a role that he fulfills as a cricketer at the moment that actually he can probably do better than anyone else in English cricket, even though he's not the finished article. And I can see where a scenario where the first two tests are real sort of slugfests, draws. England find they don't quite have that penetration. So they feel they don't need quite as much batting depth, which means that Jackson Livingston, their value is lessened, but they do want someone who they feel can buy a wicket here and there. And that's where Rian Ahmed really comes into it. And if you're looking for a leggy who can bat at number eight, that is a role that he does, which no one else in English cricket does. So there is a route for him into the side. Again, I would be surprised if that happens.
He bowls a great googly as well, and Babar can't pick him. So you know, so that gives him a bit of a leg up. There's another crucial part to all of this, and that is that the English cricket, and Rob Key in particular, having been around for a long time watching English cricket and England cricket, is kind of, he and the rest of them are all very much the opinion that the cupboard is pretty much bare when it comes to spin. Hence, you've got Jacks, hence you've got Livingston, hence now they're introducing the youngster to it. I'd have massive amount of trepidation if it was kind of like Rian Ahmed is the saviour, we're bringing him in, he's going to be the next Shane Warne. I don't think they've picked him under those circumstances at all. I think he's there, they're going to assimilate him, the players will get around him and try to expedite his learning, make it happen faster than perhaps it might have been if he'd been left to his own devices in the county game. And I think that's basically where it is. And if he does end up playing under the sort of circumstances as described, then that wouldn't be a terrible thing either. I mean, let's face it, these guys are, you know, they are the SAS rogue heroes, aren't they? This England lineup, and they're going to do mad stuff, and they don't really care what happens. You know, even Baz McCullum today has spoken about the fact that
we're still going to lose.
And if we lose trying to do it our way, then so be it. You know, and that kind of it's tantalising in terms of the expectations for the series, really, because that idea that you really don't care, the losses don't matter, is kind of, it makes you a difficult team to play against, I guess.
I can see Stokes as Captain Sterling. I can well see that.
I think he's a bit more paddy, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, I should shout. Yeah, fair enough. Just on Stokes, captained Leach brilliantly, didn't he, last summer? And especially, where was it? Was it Headingley, I think, where he gave him his head on that first day and he ended up, I think he took 10 across the game. Yeah. It was Headingley. And he kept him on early on in the piece, despite it being Headingley and day one and so on. And he set good fields to him, and he's just injected him, Leach, with a degree of confidence that he'd never really had before. And I think it was shown, therefore, in how he bowled. But he was prepared to live a little as a consequence of the way that Stokes was captaining him. So even if Rian Ahmed is just simply along for the ride and Stokes and McCullum want to size him up and work with their experts in the nets and so on, so if nothing else, he just gets the rhythm of Test cricket, then there is value in that in and of itself, I think. And Stokes knows exactly what he's looking for from his cricket teams, and it wouldn't be this current incarnation of them if they didn't have 18 players, all of whom are distinct, all of whom have something unique and specific to offer. This, if you like, this social experiment of a Test match team.
As much as, like, Mark, you're saying that they've picked him in a way before he gets, and I think Vaughan's used the phrase, entrenched in county cricket before, that you've got to pick players before they get sort of subsumed into that. I think there's also an element where they want to pick him, at least in the Test squad, before he gets sort of sucked into the franchise circuit as well, I think. I think they've said he would have played that Australia ODI series were it not for this Test series. Now he will likely play white ball cricket for England very soon. Once that happens, and even possibly before then, there are so many of these competitions, and he is such an attractive proposition that he will end up playing. I would be very surprised if he doesn't play some sort of franchise cricket over the winter, and there is the danger of that happening, and then all of a sudden you lose this guy as a Test prospect. Like, you know, when does he next get a good run of first class game? So you pick him now, make him think like, this is something that is really realistic, something I should be aiming towards as well. And I think that's part of it as well.
It's Yaz's old point about Harry Brook. You have to get him in early because you lose him to the circuit otherwise. Mm.
I think there's definitely a part of it. And just on what his career trajectory could be, Adil Rashid went to the West Indies for a Test tour in 2009 when he was 20, didn't play, and he peaked about 10 years after that. So that would be...
Was 2009. Lost the first one. Jerome Taylor in the first, drew the second by refusing to declare.
I think drew pretty much all the rest by a few seasons.
Drew the last two games. Yeah. Yeah, last two. It was a shocker.
It was one when I interviewed Ravi Papara for a cover story and lost the tape recorder. And I had to make it all up.
And Sarwan, best batter in the world? Was that a...
Sarwan, yeah. Apparently, according to some magazine or other, that I was not in charge of at the time. And again, you know, Chris Schofield as well, fast-tracked. Mason Crane, albeit, you know, he was one of the last men standing on that tour, but he still got his test cap at Sydney.
Yeah, I mean,
Parkinson's been sniffing around.
There's always been a hint of desperation around the picking of a leg break bowler, and that all began with Warnie's ball to Gatt all those years ago. Yeah. That we had, you know, you needed one, you had to have one. You know, even somebody who had as, you know, so on the other end of the spectrum, you have Ian Salisbury who had a terrific, you know, the middle to end part of his career here at the Oval where he was unplayable. You know, he out bowled Saturday in second innings of matches by quite some margin here. Saki used to get him in the first inning, but then couldn't transfer that into test cricket in any way, shape or form. So look, it's tantalizing. It's something that you shouldn't have an enormous amount of expectations for or from the lad. There's no pressure on him, I don't think, and that certainly won't be the way that he'll be treated by the team and that squad. And it'd just be fascinating because if the gamble pays off, the punt pays off, and suddenly this guy takes to it like a duck to water, and it isn't against the realms of possibility that will happen. It's unlikely, but it's not impossible. Then you've taken a great gamble and had an incredible return for it.
Just on Warn, there was a video that resurfaced this week from I think the agency that's linked with Rahane, of Rahane when he was 13 bowling in a net session during the England West Indies Lords Test in 2017, and Warn, who's on part of the Sky coverage team, was watching him bowl, and he very complimentary, and went as far as saying, "I think you could be playing first class cricket by the age of 15."
Right.
In a very Warn like delivery, and he wasn't far off.
Yeah, all he's got against him is the overwhelming streak of history. I mean, no one's ever done it before. That's the only thing against him. It's literally the only thing against him, that no one's ever done it in the history of English Test cricket, effectively.
In the absence of any other option, you're not losing anything, are you?
For sure.
It's not like you. Sure. It's not like
you've left. Different.
It's not like you've picked him, and left Peak, Embury, and Edmonds at home. You know, that's not the case.
No,
we're not. That's not where we are. So it doesn't matter.
On that warm up game, by the way, it was supposed to be a 3-dayer between England and England Lions. But on a very flat wicket with very short boundaries, they decided they'd be better off doing their own thing on the third day. It is just a brilliant scorecard, though. So England batted first on day one, scored at more than 6 runs and over. Crawley hit 96 off 89. He was run out by Jofra Archer with a direct hit, who also hit him on the head in the first over of the day. So good to see Jofra back. He was clocked at 90 mph as well. Ollie Pope, who was captaining that England side, hit 146 off 120. Livingston, 36 off 23. And then Jacks, 84 off 48. Every single Lions bowler went at more than 4 and over, including Rahane Ahmed, who went at 9.
Well, they avoided the second new ball again, didn't they? This team absolutely hate facing the second new ball. I think they did it twice all summer. And yeah, 500, I think in literally 79 overs, it's almost as if that's what they're planning.
And then on day two, the Lions scored 415 in a day themselves, which is an extraordinary achievement, really, against a test quality bowling attack. Haseeb Hameed scored 145 of 172. Tom Haynes, 82 of 100. Jack Haynes, 36 of 42. Then Rahane Ahmed himself, 26 off 10, and then Matt Fisher, 40 off 19. It looks like all the new faces have definitely got the memo about how they want to play. We talked a lot on last week's pod about how we thought Pakistan would line up, so feel free to rewind to that episode to hear more on that. But let's talk about England now. We've got all the info we need, I guess, to talk about it. How do you think they're going to line up in that first test match, Phil?
Right, I asked you before the show, is there anything that you need me to research? I didn't know you wanted an 11.
You can throw it to me if you like, Phil.
My instinct is that Will Jacks will play, and Leach, and two seamers, and Stokes. That would be my guess. There you go.
Yeah.
And we know that Brook is almost certainly going to play in the middle order in the Bairstow slot, and I think the rest has picked itself. Duckett opened for the proper team, if you like, the senior team, in that silly little game the other day. I think he's in there by a nose. I think he suits the profile of what they're looking for a little bit more than Jennings. So that would be my team, I would guess.
I guess the one thing is, obviously, looking at the squad quite far out, it seemed like that was going to be the makeup, because you could almost put the players into pairs. You know, you had the two speedsters, you had the two English-style seamers, you had the two part-time spinners, whackers at number eight. But I do think that England will actually, like, they haven't fully decided on that themselves. I think they'll wait to see what the pitch is. Are like, although they have been flat in Pakistan for the most part since Test cricket resumed there, there has been the odd sort of more seam friendly pitch. And I guess Mark Wood is injured, so they do have the option of Overton at 8, Robinson 9, Anderson 10. That would be, well, Leach 10, Anderson 11. That's, and I don't think that's completely out of the question.
No, it's not at all. It's not at all. It may well be that they think, you know, Overton is a good workhorse. You know, and get through the overs and hopefully not flag too much and be round about the kind of mark that they need, and that he might be a little bit more effective in that possibly futile pursuit of 20 wickets on a flat one than Jax, who is game and very talented multifunctional cricketer, but still averages the best part of 40 plus with the red ball, albeit that's in England. So it's every chance that they could go with that. I think Robinson and Anderson probably... stick-ons, Mark, you would think, to take the new ball?
Yeah, and because of that, I think they're going to need to play... I mean, we don't know what sort of state Ben Stokes is in, do we?
No.
In terms of his bowling, because if your second spin option is a part-time one that you're not expecting to get, you need people who are going to be able to bowl volumes of overs in Pakistan, because you have to imagine that you're going to spend upwards of a day and a half in the field every time you're in the field, unless you get to the back end of the game, right? And so to go in with two seamers of the type of Anderson and Robinson, have Stokes as your third, who you don't know how much work he's going to be able to get to, because you know what he's like. He'll give you a spell of 20, but then that might be it, right? He'll give you one spell and he'll just keep going until the leg goes. So they might find themselves in a situation where Folks bats has to bat a seven and they have to play Overton. And so they end up with four seamers and a spinner that they know is going to be able to bowl all day. I mean, he bowled, 95 overs or whatever in the West Indies over the course of that exactly. Riveting test match in Barbados.
And I think you bang on Leach. And as mentioned, you know, he bowled for 2.5 days across that Headingley test match. Stokes backs him, I think, to do that holding role. And if a team wants to think, all right, well, we can take him down and then expose the bowling attack by removing him, then I think Stokes probably backs him enough to come back and offer something else. You know, not everybody's Rishabh Pant, right? Yeah. So I think he has confidence in Leach to do that job. And
I just think the issue is that with the two guys who you're going to want, you know, who are your sort of spearheads there in Robinson and Anderson, will have large periods of the game where they're not going to be massively effective.
So that's why I won.
The same would probably be the case with Overton, right? They're all very much for muchness.
Well, precisely. The lack of Mark Wood not being able to play causes you this conundrum.
Indeed.
And it's whether or not you feel that you're going to have another seam bowler as backup, or you kind of you close your eyes, hold your nose a bit, and go, we hope that one of our two part-time spin bowlers, one of our three part-time spin bowlers, I suppose you could say, is good enough to be able to shoulder some of that burden and pick up a wicket or two.
So I think the and what I thought when I saw the squad originally, and this is where Mark Wood's injury does complicate it, is I think, and I do think England were thinking they were going to go in with one hold-up and end-style seamer, one sort of guy who can break the game open. But the thing is that Robinson and Anderson are both just better bowlers than Overton. So actually, I would back them more to break a game open, even though Overton might be a couple of miles an hour quicker. And I guess what they have also done is they just look back at that Australia series. And so this is the thing, I think they do probably back Jax / Livingston to get through a lot of overs, because if the pitches are like those, how they feel the game will go is how it went then, which was you might take a couple with the new ball, then everything goes out of the game and you just have to basically just get through it. You have to sit in and hold and just like wait until it starts reversing. And then because, so you need spinners who can bowl lots of overs, But actually, what they found in that series, Australia, is that it didn't really matter how good their spinners were. Like, they weren't going to be particularly penetrative. So actually, you can pick a guy for his other suit as long as you think he can just bowl them at like an only serviceable level. I think one point that's worth making, though, is that if that is to be Will Jax's role, it's kind of a bit of a hiding to nothing for him in terms of how people are going to end up viewing this in a few months' time. You know, this is a guy who deserves to be considered one of the, you know, the most exciting, most talented young bats in the country, is likely to be picked to sort of whack a few at number eight on some very flat pitches, so maybe winning and trying to set up a declaration, and then maybe bowl loads of overs without much hope of taking a wicket. He could easily come out of this series having kind of done his job with a really unflattering set of figures, and that just needs to be taken into account when we look at how Jax is doing and think, like, he could well end up averaging 50 with the ball and 20 with the bat and kind of having done his job in a weird way.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the thing, it wasn't so long ago that people thought that Joe Root could be your bona fide second spinner, and you're asking him to do the same thing. I mean, I wouldn't like that for the simple reason that might need him to bat for 2 days. You don't want him bowling 30 overs as well. You know?
I'll add, you will need him to bat for two days.
Precisely. Precisely. It's a tricky one. Because if things are very, very flat, you're kind of thinking to yourself, I cannot see, you know, this team is all about, we're going to do everything we possibly can to take 20 wickets. And I think if the pitches are really flat, I don't see them doing that. Without having more resources, you know what
right.
I mean?
In which case, it might be that it's a moot point. Filling your team with bowlers doesn't always necessarily work. It doesn't give you necessarily that many more options, you know, because three ramrod straight medium pacers in Pakistan you might be able to have half a dozen, and you're still going to be struggling, right? However, if that is going to be their approach, and McCullum's already outlined it, not that he needed to, then is there possibly an argument that Brooke sits on the bench, Stokes bats five, Folks bats six, and then they can play, for example, two of Jax and Overton at 7 and 8? So you've still got a pretty solid mid to lower order there. And Robinson can hold a bat number 9 as well, Leach 10, Anderson 11. So then you've got the cover for Stokes' knee, you've got the cover for it being 35 degrees and Anderson being older than you, almost. And you do have a bit of variety in there. Now, you know, ideally, of course, you want a bit more solidity in the middle order, because if you do get blown away 40 for 2 or 3 with the new ball, which is the only real threat out there, then you can be exposed, of course. You know, there's different ways. But I can imagine that might be a conversation that they'll be having. Mm.
No, definitely. The thing with Jay Moses, I'm trying to think, I was actually quite surprised he got picked in the squad, because he makes his debut in the summer, scores 97 from the bat, didn't have a great time with the ball, and that was it. We didn't see him again. He's picked in this squad ahead of Matt Potts, for example, ahead of Sam Cook. So there must be something to do with the pace they think he can bowl,
and also
involved in that selection. But sorry, and then I'm trying to work out, how can you have Overton in that team? I think his batting must be quite a big reason why they selected him. He had a really good summer with the bat as well as the ball.
Right.
So yeah, I can see
He averaged 55 with the bat in Red Bull cricket. He also got wickets out there with the older ball. And obviously we work here at the Oval, right? So we watched a lot of it. And he did change games for Surrey. And there was a bit of juice out there. It wasn't a kind of traditional flat one, feather bed at the Oval by any means. But still, with the old ball, when players were in, he came in second, third spell, and he did change the direction of the game. He didn't bowl that badly in that test either, I don't think. You know, he got rid of, I think it was Conway, you know, knocked his front pad off and did okay without being great by any means. But I can understand why they would want him in there as a slight point of difference. You know, go and explore the middle of the pitch when nothing's happening for 10 minutes, see what happens. He bounced people out last year, bowled a couple of very quick spells. So I can get it. I can see it.
I just think he's a bowler whose pace is quite inconsistent. So his top speed is pretty sharp. It's just he doesn't tend to bowl those spells consistently through a game. So that's why I'm thinking that if he gets in the team, they might play him instead of Jax at number 8. I mean, and also, McCullum's been quite clear that they're not going to prejudge the pitches at all. They haven't played a test there for 17 years, so they're going to see what they've got in front of them before coming to any conclusions. Question from Billy. He asks, how excited are you for this series overall? I feel thrilled at the thought of Root and Stokes going nuts on a day 2 flat wicket, but I also worry that it'll be drab and boring overall.
What's your alarm call Mark for Thursday morning?
I reckon I'm going to be in the studio at, oh, probably three? About, well, I think we go on air at 4:30, so yeah, 3 o'clock. So I'll be up around about 2:30, I should think.
You sound excited.
It's been a little while since I've done it. I cut my teeth on overnights in the Sky Studios, all the way back as far as England playing against Pakistan back in 1999, 2000. So
Blimey, you were in there for that?
I was in there for that. So this is almost like a homecoming to me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Ben, are you a bit more excited than Ben?
Benefit, yeah.
I'm absolutely buzzing for this series, actually.
There we go.
And actually, as long as the games aren't complete, total board draws, as long as there's something in it going into those final days, and with this England team, that should be the case. They're not going to let games drift. If there is any sort of games to be set up, they will try and do it. And in those cases, I actually really like those first 3 days when you still have narratives from, like, you know, any of that England top, you know, whoever the top eight are, any of those makes a score, that's going to be interesting and fun and good to watch. And the same goes for Pakistan, really. You have, you know, lots of interesting stories throughout their lineup. And then, there's all the tactical questions, as we talked about how teams go about finding 20 wickets. So, you know, there might be the odd dull patch of play, but, you know, this is England. It's not going to be dull for too long, I think. And also, I'm just so excited for Test cricket to be back after, like, quite a long time without it. There's a real spurt of Test cricket now between, what, this Wednesday when that Australia series starts, and then something like the 8th of January. There's, like, I think maybe 8 different countries are in Test action. I'm looking forward to that whole thing and getting into the rhythm of that again.
And I think the crowds are going to be really good, especially that first Test match, looking at sellouts as well.
I'm dead excited, yes. That's all.
No, I am. I'm less so about my alarm call, but I'm looking forward to the games because I don't think anyone's ever has ever gone out there with the idea of kind of being hyper aggressive playing in Pakistan. You know, the accepted way to play there is that you kind of, everybody sort of sits in and you hope that it all goes crazy on the last day. You know, that's kind of how Test matches have been won there traditionally. So the idea that you'd be trying to push back or trying to force the issue from early on is quite a tantalising one, because who knows, it might just work.
And I think with Pakistan as well, we talked about it last week, but you're looking at 2, possibly 3, possibly 4 debutants in the first game as well. So just seeing how those inexperienced guys do, that's going to be really fun as well.
The 19-year-old attack leader.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sensational. It's going to be a lot of fun.
And just finally on this series, Ben Stokes today announced that he'll be donating his match fees to the Pakistan flood appeal after devastating floods in Pakistan led to the deaths of over 1,500 people earlier this year. So,
good on him.
Some more England men's news this week. Luke Wright has been named as a selector, but not the selector. So more James Taylor than Ed Smith. I guess it's not huge news, but something our Wizards in India team have commented on this week is that this is the appointment of someone who gets the current landscape of cricket, the choices facing elite players at the moment, and is someone who's played a lot of T20 cricket in India. It's common for selectors to have no experience of T20 cricket, and Wright has obviously played loads of games.
Well, it's almost mandated, because I think this is set against India searching for a selector at the moment, and there's a job spec that goes up, and it says they had to have been retired from professional cricket for 5 years, and that rules out loads of people who would probably make good selectors. I guess they don't want someone who's too close to any current players and stuff, but also they have sort of you have to have played this many Test matches or this many first class games, but there's not, like, if you haven't played that much but you have played a lot of T20s, you can't have played loads of T20s and be eligible for it. So that's where that's coming from, I think.
Any strong opinions on the appointment of Wright?
No, good luck to him.
No. No, well, only to say that I think that the key McCullum, Stokes, Bobat, Court axis have got a pretty good idea what it is that they want, and so they've now got themselves, I suppose, a voice from very, very close to the game from a player's point of view. And going back to what Mr. Buckley was saying earlier on, young Jeff over there, about Rob Key sort of making the point about sort of the way that you have to sort of navigate your way through the idea that some players are going to be more attracted to white ball tournaments, all this type of thing, knowing where the opportunities are coming, knowing where the potential pitfalls might be, knowing perhaps to get in front of in front of a player's career before they sort of had their head turned by all of those types of things is something that's useful to have on board. So I'm guessing that Luke Wright is going to sort of fulfill that type of role for them. But I do get the feeling that those guys pretty much know what they want, regardless of that. And he's an added extra to something that they feel is working pretty well anyway.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. In the five names you list out there, listeners will know a lot about the first three, but nearly nothing about the other two. And it is quite interesting. Obviously, we work in the game, so we're more aware of them. But how much power that Boban and Court seem to have and the respect they have from Stokes, McCullum and Rob Key in particular. Next up, we'll talk about the prospect of private investment in the 100 and John Lewis's first squad as England coach.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So over the weekend, Sky reported that the ECB has received a £400 million private equity approach that would see it relinquish majority ownership of the 100 whilst raising funds that would end up with the counties. It's a bit light on detail at the moment, so I won't spend ages on it today. But that combination of words there, private investment, equity, the 100, may be quite triggering to quite a few cricket fans. Should we be excited or should we be scared about this? Birch.
Unless you've had your eyes closed for the last 2 or 3 years, I think that offer and that the idea that private equity might come knocking for the 100 is entirely what was on the table from the very beginning. Although I say on the table, it was under the table. It wasn't explicit in the reasonings for bringing the tournament in. But it doesn't surprise me in the slightest because I think that's been the aim all along. And I guess that at this early juncture, only 2 years in, that knocking them back or sort of holding off on diving in for this for the offer is based around, well, we think it could go higher than that. It doesn't come as any sort of surprise. Perhaps the little surprise is that it's come quite so fast. But I think then if you look at it from the point of view of the people who are trying to stump up the money, and what was it, an 80% share they'd end up with? I mean, that's vaguely terrifying, isn't it? Is that they see it as being good value at the moment, you know? So, you know, for them, they made the offer because they think, well, we can get it while it's young and have something that's... something that potentially is worth a heck of a lot more than that in 5 years' time. So watch this space. It will happen again.
Mm. And I guess it's another example of seeing like the warped power dynamics at play where counties might end up giving up quite a lot of power because they're going to be promised a lot of money. And in the long term, decisions might be made that they don't like and might be to their detriment, but they can't really do anything about it because they're so desperate for money.
It's what happened, obviously, when it pushed through that 1.3 million annual payment, you know, the mother of all bribes, if people choose to look at it from that perspective, that was so persuasive to certain cash-strapped clubs that they felt they couldn't say no. And of course, the Constitution requires, I think, 12 from the 18 to put their thumbs up. And that money was so immediately required for certain clubs that it became irresistible. And so this is... the same principle on a more expansive level. As Mark says, it's absolutely inevitable that it was going to happen. Whether it happens with this particular deal or whether this is the first point of negotiation and that another deal is eventually signed, but it will happen at some point. And the thing is, the ECB need the money, right? If you speak to people within the organisation, then they have many grand plans and plans to expand in certain areas that are underfunded as we speak, recreational cricket in particular, youth cricket in particular, women's cricket as well, for all the top end expansions and the positive stories that come out, there's still a massive dearth of cash at the grassroots level. So they do have plans, but they don't have much money. They don't have anywhere near the funds that they used to have. And so it does feel a bit ugly and vulgar and desperate, and those terms can be triggering, as you rightly say, but this is the world that cricket is trying to navigate, and this is, of course, the nature of the beast as well. When you set a tournament up like this, you're not doing it for a laugh. You're doing it to try and financially future-proof the game, you know, and develop more people who are watching it. However ugly or empty it may be for you know, proper fans, in inverted commas, nonetheless, that's why they did it.
I agree that that all the signs point to the ECB wanting some sort of private investment into the 100 in some form. But I don't know if they would have expected a bid of this magnitude to come in this early. But also, I don't know if they would have wanted to actually give up a controlling stake in the competition, or if they would rather go more down, say, like the IPL model, where the tournament is still run and kind of owned centrally, but the franchises are owned privately, a lot like with football as well, you know, with who runs the game there. And you could almost get possibly an interesting kind of a reverse situation to before, where the ECB were really trying to push this thing through and therefore saying to the counties, we'll give you this money to push this thing through. Whereas now you could almost have the case where, because the counties will have a vote on this if there is a serious bid, right? Like that's how that will work. And you could have a situation where the ECB are actually not that keen to give up a stake, possibly, because they think that they'll be able to sell it for Y further down the line rather than X now, or they might hold out for just someone coming in to buy Oval Invincibles rather than coming in to buy the whole thing and that sort of thing. And yet the counties are so attracted and dependent on the money that is being offered to them immediately that it's almost a reverse situation, I guess.
No, that's interesting. And the other thing is, when the idea of having an English competition like this, the idea was for it to be one of the best in the world and maybe not compete with the IPL straight away, but be number two. Already since the 100 came about, the PSL has gone from strength to strength. You've got this new UAE league that's going to start in January that's offering players way more money than the top players get in the 100. So where's this extra money going to come from to attract those players? Right. And then also you've got the SA20 competition that's also starting this year. And the list of names in that competition is you know, in some ways rivals the IPL.
What's the Jofra Archer team lineup?
So Jofra Archer, Rashid Khan, Sam Curran, Liam Livingston, Jewel Brevis, Kagiso Rabada are on the same team.
And Grant Rolofsson as well, right?
Yeah, and Grant Rolofsson, who played...
My boy.
Who we played against Phil in the summer.
Yeah, he's still shaking from having faced me down at number three.
The big bash
is on the floor as a consequence of, you know, of cold hard economics, right? And I guess if you build a tournament around the bottom line and it's specific and it's unashamedly driven by money and the making of it and the acquisition of it, then you sort of live and die at the altar of that, right? And the big bash, unfortunately for it, can't compete with these newfangled tournaments that you mentioned. Now, obviously, the 100 is going to be under exactly the same kind of pressure. We saw it last year, and the year before, albeit it was more the COVID umbrella the year before, but we saw it. The number of players who had given a nod that they'd be in it, turning around and saying, you know what, I'm going to have a few weeks off, thanks all the same. And it can be presented as R&R, but in reality, that's not worth my while. It needs to be worth the while of these world stars, or else it will continue to feel a little bit parochial as it did last summer.
And I think one thing that's been reported is that a big part of why they're interested in is just what they see is the immense potential of the women's tournament, that it's been so popular. The attendance is, they're breaking all sorts of records, and it's only really going in one direction. So moving on, England have named their first squad of the John Lewis era as they travel to West Indies for a pair of white ball tours. There are comebacks for Nat Siver, Catherine Brunt and Heather Knight, who all missed the series against India for one reason or another at the end of the summer. Nat Siver was taking a mental health break at the time. Brunt was rested and Knight was out injured. There is also a recall for Lauren Winfield Hill, who's had a really, really good year since losing her place in the England setup 12 or so months ago. Tammy Beaumont is in the ODI squad, as expected, but not the T20 group, which is a particularly important one to be announced at this point because the World Cup gets underway in February. Youngsters Freya Kemp, Alice Capsey, Izzy Wong, and Lauren Bell are all there. That series kicks off in a week or so's time. In Australia, They, as I mentioned already in the show, Australia is set to play West Indies in a two-test tour that starts this week. Tajinarayan Chandrapal is a near certainty to debut for West Indies. He's the son of Shiv Narayan. He scored 100 in the warm-up game against a side that was effectively the Australia A team. Most importantly, though, his stance is nearly identical to his dad's, which is great to see.
That's marvellous. The legend lives on.
Yeah, exactly. And he's got his overall first-class record's not that good, but it's very much split down the middle. In the last couple of years, it's amazing. So he's coming into his potential debut in really good form.
His tempo is really similar to his dad as well. He's a real sort of a grind out opener. So it could be a real fun opening day with Craig Brathwaite and Chandrapal. I don't think they'll be declaring before the second new ball.
It's going to be fascinating to see him. You're right what you say about Chandrapal, obviously. You know, he could bat for days and not do anything, but he also strummed a 69 ball 100, didn't he? Yeah. I also saw him to get an outrageous 100 live. Georgetown? Yeah, it was, yeah. In an ODI game, and he swept big Steve Harmison for six a couple of times. Unbelievable player, really.
There's a game he won with the last ball six as well on ODI, I think.
Yeah, I think that was the same tour.
A brilliant player, Chandrapal. Actually, one of my early favourites, weirdly, because you just look at these scorecards and think, how is this guy always just getting some sort of score and not out at the end amid like a crumbling team?
But the tickets have gone nowhere.
Yeah, that's putting it politely, really. So various media reports in Australia are saying this could be a record low test attendance for a game in Western Australia. One report suggested that they haven't even broached 1,000 ticket sales for one of the days in the first test match, at Perth, which is obviously, you know, we would talk about how excited we are seeing Pakistan, England in front of full houses in Pakistan. Well, this could be played in front of no one, just as the ODI series, perhaps even worse than the ODI series we just saw last week. Steve Waugh today said that the Australian public is almost overdosed on cricket. For the fans and spectators, it is hard to make a connection because you're not sure who is playing.
But I don't understand that. I mean, when did they last play a test match?
They played away to Sri Lanka in July.
Right, we're in November.
And then before that, away to Pakistan. So they've not played at home since the Ashes,
yeah.
Which England were rubbish then, and they're good now.
And yeah, I just don't follow that argument.
I guess they've had a World Cup, two white ball series as well. And I guess one thing about Australia as well, it's different to England where you can spread the games around a bit more. If you have a more low-key series, like when England play Ireland, they'll go and play at Bristol, and sometimes, well, we've criticised the England women's games have been at smaller places, smaller grounds. But, you know, when the World Cup was here, it was, off at Taunton and that sort of thing. In Australia, you do just have, like, not very many population centres. So actually, you'll have more international games per city per year, even if it's sort of the same amount as in England. So you have more choice. Like, if you're someone and you've got X amount of money to spend on sports tickets, and you're looking, do I spend it on an England Australia ODI? I know no one went to that either, but or a West Indies Test match. You see what I mean? Like,
I do. I'm not saying that it's not profoundly concerning for the game, but I think that's a simplistic explanation for why.
Yeah, definitely.
I think there are other factors that are more significant that are at play there.
It would just be great for West Indies to put up some sort of fight in that first Test match, because I think Australia fans will be looking at it thinking like that's a foregone conclusion, considering how uncompetitive West Indies have been there in recent test tours. And yet, you know, they, as England well know, they do have players that can trouble the best teams. And then once, if it's, you know, the first 2 days, there's like a Australia, you know, shot out for something competitive, or West Indies, one of them makes 100 and they make a decent total. And then all of a sudden you have interest in the series, and then the next game, maybe you see the ticket sales start going up. I'd really love to see that, because at the moment, if it starts badly for West Indies and then the sales where they are, then it could be a real real series to forget, I guess.
It's just two tests.
It is just two tests, yeah.
And then South Africa for three.
Yeah. One performance from that warm-up game. So West Indies were basically playing the Prime Minister's 11, which was effectively an Australia A team. There's a 22-year-old offie called Todd Murphy who caught the eye. He took 3 for 27 from 22 overs, and one wicket in particular where he beat Josh De Silva through the gate has done the rounds on social media, partly because of how similar the second half of his action is to Graham Swann. So Wisden did a tweet
basically asking people, does his action remind you of anyone? And Swan replied himself. and it is a pretty good chance. He's only played 5 or 6 first-class games, but there's a decent chance he gets picked for their tour of India in the new year. So Murphy was picked ahead of Mitchell Swepson, who played 4 test matches for Australia early this year. And it's not that clear who the second and third spinners will be. So Ashton Agar also played that game, but Murphy comfortably outbowled him. And then Adam Zampa is about to play his first-class game in about 4 years this week, so it could be an outside bet. He's obviously had a really good couple of years in limited overs cricket for Australia. Next up, Afghanistan, Ben, have effectively qualified for the 2023 World Cup. Do you want to explain how they've done that and what this means for the rest?
Yeah, well, they've done it by winning lots of games of ODI cricket, I suppose, and that's given them enough points in the World Cup Super League. The reason why I say effectively, so they now have 115 points, I think. None of the teams below them can reach that mark, but there is a chance that Afghanistan lose all their remaining games and get lots of bowling or over-8 penalty points, which would see them slip back down. But no, they are basically through. So that will mean that at least two of West Indies, Sri Lanka and South Africa go into the qualifier next year. And quite possibly all three, because Ireland have 3 more games against Bangladesh. And if they win those, they'll be ahead of West Indies. And it will leave South Africa and Sri Lanka both with very little margin for error. And they've got some tough series coming up. So South Africa would need to beat England pretty much, I think. Sri Lanka would need to go to New Zealand and win that series, as well as winning the last ODI against Afghanistan. And, you know, it's fully deserved for Afghanistan. They have had an easier fixture list when you look at who they've played, but they were brilliant to win that first ODI of the series.
They've won 11 out of their 13 played games.
Yeah. One player that I really like is Fazal Haq Farooqi, who took 4 wickets in that first ODI. And he just looks like a kind of a reasonably complete white ball bowler. He was with the new ball, he bowled a sort of a nice little wobble seam which cut back in to take off the top of Chan Mazz off stump, and then basically sealed the game with a yorker to Lakshan, I think, just when him and Hasaranga were looking like putting together a reviving partnership. And that's kind of that, I guess that's the thing that Afghanistan have missed at times. You know, they've got Majeed, this brilliant opening spin bowler. Obviously, they do this thing with Rashid Khan where they hold him back for as long as possible. So the opposition
I think that's what partly won the game of the day. So they were chasing 280 odd, I think, and Afghanistan just held Rashid Khan back for so long. So Sri Lanka took so many risks against bowlers 5-6, which is Afghanistan's problem. And when Rashid Khan comes on, the game's pretty much done.
Clever. And then he cleans up, yeah. And actually, so because Bangladesh have always had a really good Cricket World Cup Super League campaign, I guess they're one of the other teams that you might not have expected before it to qualify. I would actually put Afghanistan possibly ahead of Bangladesh in the dark horses stakes for that World Cup in terms of on their day maybe troubling some of the best teams. But yeah, it should be a really good tournament, and also that qualifier will also be really exciting as it was last time.
We're waiting for a standout Afghan batsman, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think we've got a better idea of who it could be. So the two openers.
So Zadran's a kid, isn't he? Like 20
yeah, so he's 20, and Rahman is also 20.
Right.
And I think they've got 4 ODI tons between them, and they complement each other quite well. Rahman is in the Phil Salt mode of really going for it for ball one. Zadran's a bit more of a classical player.
Yeah.
Zadran, I think he scored 75 in a test match when he was 18.
Yeah.
So together.
And he peeled off 100, right? I haven't seen too much of him, but we're just waiting for that because you can reel off half a dozen bowlers. And obviously Mo Nabi as well did a bit of both. But an out-and-out batter. I know, it's like, you know, the opener Zazai has, you know, made a career for himself in short-form cricket. But an all-round, complete white ball cricketer, batter. It's only a matter of minutes. It may well be that it's one of those two. It may well be that it's both. But we're waiting for that moment, I think.
Elsewhere, New Zealand beat India in the opening ODI of their series this week with Tom Latham hitting 145 off 104 from number 5 to help New Zealand chase down 307 with 3 overs left spare.
Can I talk about the one shot I was talking about earlier quickly?
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, so he
his body physically sagged there.
he just played this this reverse sweep deliberately with the back of the bat. And it was
right.
So obviously we talked about Deploy playing the scoop with the back of the bat. But this was the reverse sweep, and so I guess the advantage is if it's really straight, you can just play the conventional sweep and paddle that fine. And then this was down quite far down the offside, so he was able to play it that way. So it was a really smart shot, and he's obviously a canny batter and is actually developing a really, really good record in the middle order, which I don't think people would have expected when you see him open in tests. You might not think he has that kind of dynamism. He was doing it all. He was he was running hard. He was hitting sixes and boundaries and really good.
He basically scored 100 off his last 50 balls as well. And then in Australia, Adelaide Strikers won the WBBL for the first time, beating the Sydney Sixers, the competition's dominant side, in the final. Deandre Dottin scored a 50 from number four and then took two new ball wickets for the Strikers, while Darcy Brown took 2 for 15 off her four overs. At one point, the Sixers were 16 for four in the run chase. And then two final things. Ben, in India, Rutaraj Gaikwad had a record-breaking day.
He hit 42 off an over, and there were 43 runs scored off the over, which is a joint List A record for runs conceded. So that was six sixes and a six off a no ball as well, which is remarkable. He made a double hundred, and obviously there's a temptation to look at this and think, you know, this is a bit of a tin port game against a weak team. This is in the quarterfinal of India's premier 50 over competition, so this is a high level, and he made 229, I think, out of a total of 330. That was a really massive, proper innings. No one else made a 50. He has now knocked off Sam Hain and now has the highest List A average of all time.
Wow.
Calls for him to get a...
He's the one who opens for Chennai, right?
Yeah, but the thing is, I think 50 over cricket is much more his game. He struggles to be aggressive straight away, but knows how to build an innings and then to expand later on. So there are calls for him to sort of get a good run in the ODI side. Whereas I think he's played maybe 70-20s and only one ODI so far. So, yeah.
And then finally, a bit of a Warwickshire link from Sam Hain to Hassan Ali, who is signed for Warwickshire for County Championship and the Blast up until the end of July in 2023. So that's another very good signing for Warwickshire, who have also signed Chris Rushworth, Ed Bernard and Moeen Ali ahead of next season. They seem intent on making sure they're not involved in another relegation scrap.
Yes. Where's my Abu Dhabi T10 update?
Well, cricket has been played in Abu Dhabi, and Nicholas Puran's hitting them well. But other than that, I can't tell you an awful lot.
I watched 10 minutes of it on a hangover on Sunday morning. It was my mum's birthday the night before. We'd had a few people over. It was a lovely evening. Watched it the following morning. 10 minutes, miserable beyond words. Almost profoundly sad, actually. And Graham Swann was commentating with Brendan McCullum. Nobody there at all. In the ground, nobody there, and Swanee said something that unwittingly captured the emptiness of the whole experience. One over in, the Warriors were playing another team. Don't know, can't remember. Anyway, the Warriors, Anyway, he said, quote, I wrote it down after one over. The Warriors look tired, said Swanee. They need to up the energy levels. Make a buzz, make some noise, jump up and down, do the splits, whatever. It's just a perfect summary of just how peculiar and grim and sad and empty the whole experience was. I don't know who it's for.
Well, they've added two more teams this year. One of whom are called like the New York Strikers or something.
There's a New York side,
Obviously, it's big in the US, I guess.
Well, why do you think...
Jump up and down, do the splits, whatever.
Why did you find it more soulless? Why did you find it more soulless than normal T20 cricket?
Well, because there's only half of it to begin with.
True.
And because there's literally nobody there. I can understand any form, any sort of tin pot tournament if it's trying to engender some sort of local interest, for sure. Totally. I don't mind. Play a five-over game in Chicago, by all means. But if there's literally nobody there, literally, who's it for? It's certainly not for us either. So I just don't know who it's for.
Yeah, and I guess one thing related to that is there was a lot of complaints from within the England squad about their series in Australia and how there's too much cricket. James Vince, the day after playing an ODI in Australia, the day after almost the other side of the world, was keeping wicket for Team Abu Dhabi. against the Deccan Gladiators.
In short sleeves. But also, on a slightly more serious point, so was Mo, right?
Yeah.
You know, and Mo had said it was horrible, that three-match ODI series, and 2 days later, he's playing out in Abs Dhab. So, yeah, that... I don't know. It rather undermines the integrity of his original point.
Absolutely. Vince is going well, though. He's hit 81 off
51 across his two games.
That's my boy.
Get him in.
Get him in somewhere.
Get him in.
And actually, him keeping in slot C is obviously normally... normally it'd be sort of like... it'd be cancelable territory, wouldn't it, for doing that. But I think it really fits this tournament, doesn't it? Like, if you're going to go over there, you can at least sort of not do it properly. And Vince is doing that and still seeing them quite well. So...
Yeah.
On that bombshell.
Thanks for listening, folks. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Mark. Cheers, Ben. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. We'll be back next week at the end of the first New Pakistan Test match.
Sports Social Podcast Network.